upon our brother Jim Cowie, that he might lead us in a consideration to the theme, "The Holy Seed had mingled themselves with the people of the land."
Thanks, Brother Kerry. My beloved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ, well, the winter has struck with a vengeance, hasn't it? And it's carried off one or two victims already. I think if we proceed this evening, brethren and sisters, and come to chapter 10, eventually we're going to see that we have at least something in common with the people in the days of Ezra, who found themselves in a plight which carried them into the streets in a time not dissimilar to that which we are sharing at this stage, the onset of winter. Not a time to be standing outside, but a time nevertheless when they had to come together to resolve a great issue that had descended upon them. I think it's fairly obvious, brethren and sisters, what we intend to speak about from our title this evening. "The Holy Seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands" is taken, of course, from verse 2 of chapter 9. It's palpably obvious that we are going to talk about the necessary separation from the evils of the world that is part and parcel of our service in the truth. I want to say from the outset, brethren and sisters, that our life in the truth is a multifarious or a multicoloured occupation. We are not just called upon to be builders in the house of God. We've been learning about that in our previous studies. That's an essential. The commitment of which we spoke last week is an essential element of our service in the truth. We're not just called upon to be students of the word, which Ezra, of course, was. A staggering example in that regard, and a man who was able to bring great benefits to his people because of the efforts that he'd made over many years, decades, of diligent study of the word, which we share in today. The benefits of that are still with us today. We're not just called upon to be students, but also to have a sensitivity to the presence of our God and to his providential workings in our life. To be able to see with the eyes of faith the angel that is with us in all the way that we go. And that, brethren and sisters, is not an easy thing to do. We've got to get to a point in life, as we saw Ezra in chapter 8, committing himself absolutely. And as they went forth from Babylon over 4 long months, as they made their way through the deserts of Arabia into the land, every morning he got up, he would have committed himself and the people with him into the hands of their God. And as the Arab Bedouin tribes passed by them, never seeing them, or if they did see them, never daring to lay a hand upon them, as day passed day, and as danger passed danger, those people came to understand the power of Ezra's example, a man who put his trust absolutely in God. And by the end of that journey, they could say with him that the good hand of our God was upon us, and he kept us in the way. We've got to come to understand that in our life, brethren and sisters. We've got to learn to see, and perhaps even to communicate with the angel that is with us, that we might make of him a friend, because one day he will make himself known to us. And we're going to find out then, perhaps what we don't even realise now, just how much he has been involved in our life and affairs. They're not the only responsibilities that we've got in the truth, brethren and sisters. There are many other things, of course. And one of those things is to be like Yahweh himself. He calls upon us to be holy even as he is holy. And like the people of Israel in the times of Ezra, we are his holy seed. And unlike them, brethren and sisters, we don't find ourselves confronted now with an issue like this, but it could happen. In fact, if we were to be more particular, we would say this, brethren and sisters, that though as a community, here at Golden Grove and perhaps on the wider scale, we are free of a problem such as we will consider tonight, nevertheless, hardly a week goes by in our brotherhood, and I mean that, hardly a week goes by when we don't hear some news of an individual here or there who has made shipwreck of their life in the truth by indulging in the same problem which had overwhelmed the ecclesia in the days of Ezra. So while it might not be happening on the grand scale, it is happening. Unfortunately and tragically, it is happening on the individual scale. And people are stumbling into the same mistake that overcame this people. So tonight we want to have a look at that problem. We want to plumb the depths of it to find out what the answer to that problem is. And it's all very simple. We know the answer. We need, brethren and sisters, though, to go over that ground again, to ponder what happened here. But that isn't the primary reason why we intend to do this study this evening. We're not going to just concentrate on negatives. As far as I'm personally concerned, the primary reason for the consideration before us in Ezra 9 and 10 tonight is that we might see how to handle an ecclesial crisis. Inevitably, brothers and sisters, we are going to have ecclesial crises. Somewhere along the line, we are going to find ourselves confronted, as all ecclesias are, with an issue or issues that will be very, very difficult to handle, which will cause brethren to be at odds one with another, which will cause people to be ashamed, perhaps, of their association with the evil that has overtaken us. Ezra was ashamed. But we're going to see how he handled that tonight. And it's important for us to grasp the characteristics of this man and his attitudes towards the problems that he faced, that we might know how to handle those issues if they ever arise in our midst. And we ought not to sit back smugly and say, it won't happen to us. Because you know as well as I do that as soon as you think that, leave alone say it, as soon as you think that, you are a prime candidate for it to happen to you. I'm a firm believer in this, brethren and sisters. If my observation of ecclesial life is anything to rely upon over 20-odd years, there's one thing that I have learned, that people who are confident in themselves, either individually or ecclesially, are prime candidates for Yahweh to intervene in their lives and to bring them down a peg or two. And we as an ecclesia need to be humble in our spirit, lest we find ourselves stumbling over a rock and plunging into a problem like this one which faced Ezra and his ecclesia. Fortunately for them, they had a man, a number of men in fact, but one at their head, who was able to grapple with that problem in a way that could see it resolved. And we need to cultivate some of those in our own midst. We need to have people like Ezra, who know what to do in a crisis, who know how to handle it. And if they do it the right way, then the result will be the same. In Ezra chapter 9, we have in the first four verses the source of the problem. Ezra mourns the breakdown of separation from the Gentiles. In verses 5 through to the end of the chapter, we have Ezra's prayer, and it is indeed a model prayer. There are many model prayers in the scriptures, but here is one, brethren and sisters, that stands out for a number of reasons. It's not just the prayer itself that's a model prayer. It's what goes before and after it that makes it a model prayer. There is a preparation. That preparation is in the first four verses. In verses 1 and 2, the problem is considered. The problem is isolated and seen for what it is. In verses 3 and 4, the mind is prepared. He doesn't just burst into prayer. There is a period of careful and mournful preparation before Ezra attempts to present his prayer before his God. Then, as I said, from verse 5 to the end of the chapter, there is the prayer itself. But it can be broken up. Verses 5 and 6 are an expression of the humiliation which he felt. And it wasn't a self-righteous humiliation, brethren and sisters. As we go through Ezra's prayer, what is going to come out to us is this, that his shame, his sense of humiliation, had nothing to do with Ezra's own sense of righteousness. It was not based upon his feelings of righteousness. He was not indignant because someone had had the audacity to besmirch Ezra's name or standing by committing such evil things as were going on. It wasn't a reflection upon him that made him ashamed. It was, brethren and sisters, as we will see as we go through this prayer, it was that he felt a sense of failure to appreciate what Yahweh had done for them as a people. It was the base ingratitude of the people to what Yahweh had done for them that made him ashamed. You see, this is a carryover from chapters 7 and 8. Here was a man who had a great sensitivity to the presence of God in his life. The Word made him that way. And having that sensitivity, brothers and sisters, he understood his own weakness and his own need. And this happens in your life. As you grow in maturity in the truth, this is what happens. You become more and more impressed with your own weakness and inability to handle the flesh in your own strength. And so you resort more and more to Yahweh's strength. You go to this book regularly, not because you've just got to do it to be a Christadelphian, but because you have to go to it to get the strength you need. And the more you go to this book, brothers and sisters, the more it tells you you've got a big problem. And you become more and more sensitive about the evils of the flesh. And you become more and more grateful for what Yahweh's done for you and the enormous forgiveness that's required in your life. And you become more and more appreciative of that. And you become more and more humble. And when you sin, it's not, brethren and sisters, the horror of the sin so much that makes you ashamed. All right, that ought to make us ashamed. We ought to be horrified at sin. But it's not that really that makes you feel ashamed. What makes you feel ashamed is that you've let your God down. But he's done so much for you. He's forgiven you so much in the past. He's been so kind and so generous. He sent his angel to guard your life. You've seen the angel working in your life. You've seen that hand, brothers and sisters. You know the good hand of your God is upon you. And you let him down. And you kick yourself around the room and you say to yourself, you idiot. You utter fool. Why would you do that to your God? Why would you do that? You ever felt that way, brothers and sisters? You ever felt that way? Have a look at this man. That's how he felt. That's why he was ashamed. It wasn't that he felt righteous, because the nation was unrighteous. Because he keeps using the pronoun our and we. He was ashamed at their base ingratitude. That the God had done so much for them had been slapped in the face by his own children. How do you feel when your children do that to you? That's how God feels when we do it to him. That's our story tonight. It's what makes it a model prayer. We're looking at an enormously wonderful character in this man Ezra, who had reached the maturity and the truth that we are struggling to attain. But if we apply ourselves, we'll get there in due time with Yahweh's help, brothers and sisters, there's no doubt about that. But we'll need to learn some lessons from this man. And so we read, as we plunge on into chapter 10, that the prayer is followed by an aftermath. The prayer ends at verse 15 of chapter 9, and then he institutes a reform. The problem is shared in verses 1 to 5 of chapter 10, and then the problem is acted upon. Now here's a model prayer. There is the problem considered, isolated, seen for what it is. Sometimes we don't always see our problems clearly. We need to see with clarity the issues of life. To paint the picture as brightly as we can, to say that's the stark reality of it. Then the mind is prepared to confront that problem. But before he confronts it, brethren and sisters, he goes to his God in prayer. He expresses his humiliation in verses 5 and 6. The sin is confessed in verse 7 of chapter 9. Yahweh's mercy is recalled in verses 8 and 9. Israel's negligence is reported in verses 10 to 14. Yahweh's righteousness is vindicated in verse 15. Now you might be writing those things down, you won't have any chance of following that, but you will find these things in the notes that you've been given. And then, as I said, there's the aftermath. The problem is shared and the problem is acted upon. And we're going to see as we come to chapter 10 that the problem is indeed resolved because of the way in which Ezra handles this matter. Well, what was the problem? We won't have time to go through every verse in these two chapters, obviously. Let's just isolate, first of all, the problem, and then just pick the eyes out of these two chapters to see if we can learn these lessons for ourselves. What was the problem? It's expressed for us in the first two verses. Now when these things were done in chapter 9, verse 1, the princes came to me saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves. The word separated is the Hebrew badal, meaning to divide, to separate, to distinguish, to differ, to select. Rotherham translates it, they have not kept themselves separate. Separation, of course, is the fundamental principle of life in the truth. The very first thing that Yahweh did in Genesis chapter 1, brethren and sisters, was to separate light from darkness. Separation was the foundation of his creative work. He separated light from darkness. And separation is the first principle of the truth. We don't see that in our young people or in those who are learning the truth. We don't see separation. We don't baptize them. Simple as that. And so these people had forgotten that fundamental. They had not separated themselves from the people of the lands. Then it says, doing according to their abominations. Now you'll notice the word doing is in italics. In fact, it could be crossed out. Rotherham translates that phrase, in view of their abominations. They are not being accused of idolatry yet. The report, brethren and sisters, is not that these people had taken strange women into their homes and that they had adopted their religion and were now serving their idols. It hadn't quite got to that stage, you see. It was early days for what was happening. There was time to nip this in the bud. They had not yet bowed down to false gods, but that would have been the inevitable end. So Rotherham's translation is helpful. It says, they have not separated themselves from the people of those lands in view of their abominations. In other words, because those people were idolaters, it was incongruous that Israelites, the holy seed, should be taking them as potential marriage partners. And he enumerates who they were, Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, etc. And he says in verse 2, for they have taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons. Let's just pause there for a moment. When it says they have taken of their daughters, the word daughters there is bat, the feminine of Ben. Ben, we know, means to be the builder of a family name. The family name, of course, is the name of the God of Israel. You'll find him mentioned in verse 4. It says in the third line of verse 4, there were those that trembled at the words of the God of Israel. There's his family name. He was the God of Israel. Here were people who were taking their daughters, their family builders, for themselves and for their sons, Ben, in the plural. Their family builders. So there was an intermingling of family builders, which would have ultimately led to the dissolution of the name Israel. That was the problem. The ultimate possibility of the dissolution of the nation of Israel, which would of course meant a complete desecration of the promises that God made to the fathers of that nation. And Ezra was large enough in his view of things, able to see the end of the matter from the beginning, to know where this was heading. And it was palpably obvious to him that unless something was done, then there would be ruination for the people of God. So that it's reported to him in verse 2, so that the holy seed, Kodesh Zirah, have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. Now that word mingled is used quite frequently in the scripture for the intermingling of peoples for business. It means to intermix, to traffic as if by bartering in a marketplace, even to give security, to stand security for someone, to be a guarantor for them in business transactions. It has the idea of people who mingle together because it's to their advantage economically to do so. So here they were mingling themselves with the people of those lands. But I don't think business was their primary motivation, brethren and sisters. I think there was another problem. We don't know why it is that this occurred. If our chronology is correct, then this problem must have occurred while the temple was actually in the last stages of being built. That's an amazing thing, isn't it? This problem must have been occurring then. It was in its early stages while the temple was still being built, because Ezra came back in the year 515. And this is not long after that he finds this problem. So you see, something had been going on. Perhaps there was a lack of women in the first Aliyah. Perhaps there wasn't enough women to go around for the 42,000 odd men of Israel who came back. And after a number of years in that land, perhaps they gave up trying to be celibate because they were forced to be celibate. Perhaps they were overpowered by that basic carnal lust of human nature, which drove them to seek the companionship of women who were not of their own race. We don't know exactly what it was that caused this problem, as far as they were concerned. But we do know a lot about the problem, don't we, brothers and sisters? We do know a lot about the problem. As I said to you at the outset, not a week, hardly a week goes by that we don't hear someone stumbling in this matter, entering into an alliance, unlawful alliance, because of that problem of our nature. And so we read that leadership was poor in this regard as well. At the end of verse 2 it says, "Yea, the hand of the princes and rulers hath been chief, foremost, in this trespass." Treachery or sin, the word trespass means. And so there's a problem isolated. How did Ezra react to this? Well, you know, we really are moving towards a situation in the Brotherhood where we're shocked by nothing. So I said, hardly a week goes by, we don't hear some news. Are you shocked by it anymore? Are you horrified by what happens? It's like water off a duck's back, isn't it? Because we hear so much of it. Is that how Ezra reacted? Have a look at verse 3. "When I heard this thing, I rent my garment and my mantle, and plucked off the hair of my head and of my beard, and sat down astonished." The word astonished, shamem, in the Hebrew means to stun, to be absolutely devastated, to be stupefied, almost as though someone had hit you across the head with a sledgehammer. "He sat stunned," says Rotherham. "He sat down stricken dumb," says the Interlinear Bible. He was absolutely decimated by this news, brothers and sisters. He sat there as though someone had punched him between the eyes when he heard of the extent of that problem. He couldn't believe it. He was absolutely overwhelmed by it. He rent his garment and his mantle. He pulled at his hair, plucked at his beard. Painful things. But he might demonstrate how frustrated he was by that news, grieved by it. And it was that demonstration, which we would say was a little bit ostentatious, that brought this result in verse 4. "Then," notice it says, "then were assembled unto me everyone that trembled at the words of the God of Israel." Why did they come to him? Well, they saw his reaction. The news got around. Ezra, our respected priest, the great scribe, when he heard this news, didn't just brush it off, as we tend to do today. Oh, well, it's happening all the time. He was staggered, grieved by it. And he showed that grief. I guarantee if you demonstrated that sort of grief today in the Brotherhood, you would be touted as a bombastic, ostentatious idiot. And I'm not suggesting that every time we hear that there's something gone drastically wrong, that we should be tearing our suit jackets and tearing out our hair if we've got any. I'm not suggesting that. But what I am suggesting is that we perhaps need, brothers and sisters, to be a little bit cautious, that we don't become so inured to these sort of things that they mean nothing to us anymore. You know why we shouldn't be like that? Because every time you hear of a brother going astray, and you'll hear it quite often these days, every time you hear that, you've just lost part of your body. You've just lost part of your body because you're part of another body. And it's our sin, our problem. Not his problem or her problem, it's our problem. The Brotherhood's problem. And we ought to be concerned about it. And if we're concerned about it, brothers and sisters, I'll tell you what you'll do about it. All right, you mightn't be able to do much for the brother who shot through with some other woman. Pretty hard to chase them up. You can't do much for him. But you can do something for those with whom you've got contact. Look around your own ecclesia. Look at the people in your ecclesia who are potentially going to be in the same position one day if we don't give them support. Look at the people in our meetings who may well be sucked in by this evil carnal desire which took these people away if we don't provide some adequate support for them. They're the ones you can do something for. And in doing it for them, brethren and sisters, you're doing it for yourself. How are we getting on with that? Are there any people in our meeting who are lonely, who are not being given enough attention? People who have got a situation in life that we would not swap with them for anything? How are we getting on with that, brethren and sisters? Well, we don't always do too well, do we? It's like a lot of things in the truth. We tend to start well. We don't carry it through. We might have thought about it when we were a young ecclesia. We might have started out with great and tremendous ideals, kept them up for a while. But it's the stayers who count in the long run. It's not those who are going along in fits and starts that make for a successful ecclesia. It's the stayers. So we ought, brothers and sisters, to learn that lesson. He was troubled because he was dealing with himself. You know what? Every time I hear a brother going astray in this matter, I groan within myself, brothers and sisters, because I know that if I was in their situation, if I didn't have the happy situation of life that Yahweh has given me, which could be taken away tomorrow, couldn't it? It could be taken away. I know if I didn't have that the pressure on me would be so great that maybe I would stagger under the weight as well. Could be me that was in that situation. And I need, every time I hear it, I need to sit carefully and to ponder what I'm doing to prevent it happening to someone else. And I'm not always happy with the result of that examination. We're all too busy. We're all too busy with our own things, or maybe even with ecclesial things. We can justify ourselves. We're at the block every Saturday. Every time there's a working bee, we're there, brethren and sisters. What about the Sunday? What about the weekdays when these brethren and sisters that need help are left languishing because we can justify it and say, well, I'm doing enough. Are we? We need to think about that. So we read in verse 4 that because of his reaction to this, the way in which he was demonstrably upset by what had happened, there were assembled unto me every one that trembled at the words of the God of Israel. I hardly need to tell you that the word trembled there is the same word used in Isaiah 66 verses 2 and 5. That this is the man to whom I will look, every one that trembles at my word. Same word. So here were a class of people who assembled to Ezra because they felt like him. They trembled at the words of the God of Israel. Because of the transgressions of those that had been carried away, doesn't mean that they'd been carried away with sin, it means that they were the exiles. And I sat astonished or stunned until the evening sacrifice. Now that's significant. He sat there like that until the evening sacrifice. Of course it was the time, 3 p.m. in the afternoon, when the priest would bring out the lamb that they might make the national burnt offering that would be placed upon the remains of the offering that was made in the morning. And there continually there would be arising the sweet smelling incense, as it were, the smoke of that sacrifice into the nostrils of Yahweh. And the priests would stand there, as it were, and raise up their hands in the attitude of prayer, that they might offer up the dedication of that people. He chose that time, brothers and sisters, to make his own prayer to his God. We read in verse 5 how he commences that. At the evening sacrifice I arose up from my heaviness, and having rent my garment and my mantle, I fell upon my knees and spread out my hands unto Yahweh my God. Now we're all familiar with Psalm 141 verse 2. We don't even need to turn it up. Let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense. You notice I've given a bit of a different translation. Let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense. and the lifting up of my hands, says the psalmist, as the evening sacrifice. Why does he use terms like that, brethren and sisters? He's talking about the setting forth of incense, prayer, projecting it into the presence of Yahweh, the lifting up of his hands, as Paul could say to those in the New Testament, let men everywhere lift up holy hands in prayer. What is that talking about? Well, lifting up your hands, of course, is symbolic of lifting up your whole life, your works. And so Ezra, as he comes before his God, brethren and sisters, in the attitude of prayer, falls upon his knees because he's ashamed and lifts up his hands in appeal to God that he might present his petitions to his Father in heaven on behalf of his people. And what a prayer it is. He said in verse 6, O my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face to thee, my God, for our iniquities are increased over our head, and our trespass is grown up unto the heavens. You see, it ought to be our works that are lifted up to the heavens. It ought to be, brethren and sisters, our whole life, head, fat, innards and legs, mentally, morally and physically, like the smoke of that sacrifice. It ought to be that which is projected into the heavens. It ought to be a total giving of ourselves. What could he offer up to God from that people? Our trespass is grown up to the heavens. It was that that was exalting itself into the heavens against God. He felt that very keenly. That's why he was ashamed and he blushed. Couldn't believe that this people who had received so much could so disregard the principles of the God who had saved them. Their base ingratitude keenly affected him, brethren and sisters. He spoke of those iniquities as our iniquities. Just like Daniel, isn't it? Daniel chapter 9, remember that in the studies? Chapter 9, verses 7 and 8 of Daniel, we read that he prayed on behalf of the nation. He was impeccable, that man. Impeccable. As much as any man can be. And yet when he prayed on behalf of the people and confessed their sins, he said, Unto us, there is but confusion of face. Same words used, actually, in the Hebrew. Confusion of face. Notice it over in verse 7 of chapter 9 of Ezra. And to confusion of face, bosheth panim, near the end of verse 7. So you see, Ezra is using the same words as Daniel. Guess where he got them from? Ezra was the successor as a scribe in Babylon to Daniel. He knew what he was doing. This prayer was modelled on another one. So he goes on to say in verse 7, since the days of our fathers have we been in a great trespass unto this day, and for our iniquities have we, our kings and our priests, been delivered into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to the captivity, and to spoil, and to confusion of face, as it is this day. And now, he goes on now, brothers and sisters, in verses 8 and 9, to express the way in which Yahweh's mercy had been revealed to Israel. And now for a little space. It was at least 21 years he was talking about. From 536 to 515, at least that period. Yet when he says a little space, the word riga means a wink of the eyes. Just a wink of the eyes. A short space of time, so that Rotherham translates it, a very little moment of at least 21 years, grace hath been showed from Yahweh our God to leave us a remnant to escape and to give us a nail in his holy place, that our God may lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. How long, brothers and sisters, has Yahweh been blessing you? You think back. How long in your life has Yahweh been blessing you individually? Well, in my case, it's as long as I've been baptized. As I survey my life, brothers and sisters, I wonder why, perhaps, we all wonder this, but I certainly wonder why I've had it so easy. And I think we get it too easy. We don't have persecution. Sometimes we, of course, cover up who we are so that we don't get persecution. We don't have to eke out an existence. We are so well off, so well fed, so well housed, that really we are in danger because of that. We get it so easy. Yahweh is blessing us in many ways, brethren and sisters, but sometimes those blessings can turn into a curse because we don't appreciate what we've got. Could be taken away. And I wonder sometimes whether or not, because of our ingratitude, we stumble into the sort of sin that has overtaken many. It's because we don't really appreciate what's been done for us that we stumble into idiotic sins. If we were perhaps oppressed, persecuted, or poverty stricken, we would be a better people. That's the simplicity of it. We would be a better people. We would appreciate what has been done for us, though little it might be. And Ezra says these people have been given a 21-year period of grace, and look what they have done. Couldn't believe it. He goes on in verse 8 to say, he's left us a remnant to escape, to give us a nail in his holy place. The word nail, yathed, means to pin through or to make fast in the wall a peg due to the pins of the tabernacle which kept it steady and stable. It's a place of stability where you can hang something knowing it's not going to collapse. And so when he says a nail in his holy place, the nail, of course, was the temple. The holy place was Jerusalem. They'd been given that place, brothers and sisters, as a place of security. But our God, he says, may lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. He'd done that. For we were bondmen, yet our God hath not forsaken us in our bondage, but hath extended mercy unto us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us a reviving, a preservation of life, the word means, to set up the house of our God, and to repair the desolations thereof, and to give us a wall in Jerusalem, a hedge or a fence, the word means. He'd hedged them in Judah and in Jerusalem. That was their blessing, brethren and sisters. All of these things given to them, just in the same way as Yahweh is giving us blessings. He'll give us an ecclesia, maybe even give us an ecclesial hall. Just like them, he had to work for it. But it's Yahweh who gives it, a place of security for us and our children, where we can come together. My children want to be in this place with your children. It's a blessing from Yahweh that it can be so, brothers and sisters. Do we appreciate that? Well, why do some of us, and I mean by us, the brotherhood as a whole, why do some of us throw the towel in and capitulate to this sin? Why did they do it then? A lack of gratitude. A lack of appreciation for what had been done for them. If they kept that vividly in their minds, they would never have done what they did. So he goes on to talk about that. We read in verses 10 to 14, their negligence is reported before their God. And he reminds the nation, in the words of this prayer to his God, brethren and sisters, of what had been said to them by their prophets. The land in verse 11, unto which ye go to possess it, is an unclean land, with the filthiness of the people. The word filthiness means their impurities. Their impurities. The word unclean there in verse 11 is a word that means utter rejection. Something that is put away from you, thrown away, flung away in rejection. They are an unclean land and a filthy people, with their abominations, which have filled it from one end to another. He could be describing the world today, couldn't he? The words from one end to the other, you'll see from the margin, mean from mouth to mouth. It's a phrase that is used of packing a place from one end to the other. It's absolutely full of people who are given over to impurity. It's a description of our world today, and we're mingling amongst that, brothers and sisters. We can't avoid that. And our children go to school every day with impure people. We can't avoid the fact that they're going to be infected in some way by that. They're going to be tainted in some way by that mentally. No question about that. I went through that. You went through that. You cannot avoid that. So this problem may well become a problem for us. If Christ tarries, brethren and sisters, it could become a problem for us. And we wouldn't be the first ecclesia that had suffered from it. We need perhaps to ponder what policies we're going to adopt. And we need to have those policies. And here's one of them in verse 12. Now therefore, give not your daughters unto their sons, neither take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek their peace or their wealth forever. Doesn't mean we shouldn't try and convert them, but it certainly means that we should never, ever, ever have any kind of association with them on any other basis than their conversion to the truth. Don't seek their peace or their wealth in the things of this life, that ye may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it for inheritance to your children forever. And so, brethren and sisters, the message is very simple. Ecclesial strength depends on separation. Separation from the world and its evils. Only then will blessings come to us. And only then will they flow onto our children. See what he says there? If you are separate, and if you keep your children separate, and they will learn to keep their children separate from the evils of the world, and not intermingle with them, you will receive the good of the land, that is, divine blessing, and you will leave it for an inheritance unto them. So that, for instance, if in 200 years' time Christ hadn't come, and that's ludicrous, of course, but if in 200 years Christ hadn't come, brethren and sisters, and you and I are long since pushing up daisies, we could have confidence that the policies of this ecclesia would still see in Golden Grove a vibrant, burning light stand. Are you confident about that? Well, it won't happen, of course. We don't think it's going to happen. We think the Lord will come well before then. But can we be confident about that? It's a very simple lesson. Teach your children to be separate from the world. And that comes right down to everyday matters. What you advise them to do at school. Whether they go here or go there or attend this or attend that, you teach them there and then how to be separate. You've got to be very careful where you choose to draw your lines. You can't be so idiotic that you put your children totally out of step with everybody else and make them martyrs. But by the same token, brothers and sisters, you cannot be so loose and so weak that you give the children the impression that separation doesn't matter. There are ways and means of teaching our children that they need to be separate. And I'll tell you what, I know from my experience, having been raised up in the truth, that it works. It does work. I would have thought that I was a fairly independent-minded young fellow. But I know that what I was taught as a child stuck. It stuck. It stayed with me. And independence and rebellion sometimes, nevertheless, I never ever abandoned those principles. I knew they were right. And we can teach our children those principles that they might hold on to them. But I'll tell you what happens if you're loose and you don't get that message across. You don't eat of the good of the land and you don't leave it for your kids. And it's happened in too many places to enumerate. It's happened. I could take you on a trip overseas, brothers and sisters, to some ecclesias that I visited, and you, like me, would come away from those places miserable. Miserable. Ecclesias of 15 or 16 people with one or two teenagers, and there are four or five families in the meeting who all would have had teenage children, and you ask them, where's your teenage kids? Gone to the world. They haven't left them anything, have they? But after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great trespass, seeing that our God has punished us less than our iniquities deserve, how true that is. The word punished, in fact, is the word for rod. Since you, our God, have hurled back the rod on our iniquities. The Interlinear Bible translates that phrase. He's held back the rod, punished us less than our iniquities deserve, and has given us such deliverance as this. Should we again break thy commandments and join in affinity? The word join there is chathen. It means to contract affinity by marriage. He was worried that what was happening would lead to the contract of affinity by marriage, but I don't believe that they had, in fact, married those women. We'll talk more about that in a moment. With the peoples of these abominations, he says, Wouldest not thou be angry with us till thou hadst consumed us, so that there should be no remnant nor escaping? Look at the final appeal, brethren and sisters. O Yahweh God of Israel, thou art righteous. Thou art righteous, for we remain yet escaped as at this day. Behold, we are before thee in our trespasses, for we cannot stand before thee because of this. Psalm 130 verse 3, isn't it? If thou wert to mark iniquities, who would stand? And Ezra saw himself in that same position, brethren and sisters. He wasn't guilty of this sin, but he knew potentially that he could be. He could be. And what had happened to his brethren had happened because they'd released their grip on the things that they believed. They'd lost sight of the realities of the truth and forgotten just how much had been done for them. They were ungrateful for the great benefits that they had received. You know, that teaches us a lesson too. If we don't teach our children to be grateful for what they receive, then they are not going to behave themselves wisely in the truth. If we let our children get away with the idea that what they've got is outstanding, that it's an enormous blessing, don't boast about it, but tell them that what they've got is an enormous blessing. And if you really want to impress it upon them, when they get old enough to appreciate it, just take them somewhere where they don't have those sort of things. You don't have to go very far in this country or overseas to find that, brethren and sisters. Take them somewhere where they don't have it. And they'll come back with a greater appreciation of what they've got. We teach them to be grateful. And you teach people to be grateful, and they're going to act wisely and behave themselves in the truth. Simple as that. So here were a people who stood naked in the presence of their God because of their sin. Well, what was their sin? They were mingling themselves with the people of the land. In what way? Well, in chapter 10, verses 1 to 5, we have the problem being shared by the people. Ezra institutes a reform. And in that section, we find out, in fact, exactly what it is that they'd done. Verse 1 we read, "Now when Ezra had prayed and when he had confessed, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, there assembled unto him out of Israel a very great congregation of men and women." You'll notice it was his activity that brought that about again. "When he had done this, then there were assembled unto him a great congregation of men and women and children, for the people wept very sore." Rotherham translates, "with a very bitter weeping." You'll notice from the margin, it is a great weeping that is involved here. Why were they weeping? Well, you see, Ezra had impressed upon them, both by his actions and by his prayer, which they would have heard, that they had committed a sin of ingratitude before their God. And moreover, they'd broken the cardinal principle of life in the truth, separation from the world. And there were men and women and children there. The word men is Enosh, means just an ordinary mortal man. Women is Noshim, which of course is related to Enosh. Now I don't want you to notice that, brethren and sisters, because you see, the Hebrew is the same as the Greek in the use of the word woman. In the Greek, the word is gunai, means a woman either married or unmarried. In the Hebrew, the common word for woman is noshim. And it does service for an unmarried woman or for a married woman, a wife. So that you find it used in that way throughout a chapter. In one instance, it clearly means an unmarried woman. In the next occurrence, it speaks of a wife. The context determines whether or not the woman is married, but the same word is used. Now that's an important factor, because I believe that what we have here in chapter 10 is the presentation of the problem that was being now nipped in the bud, but that had not in fact led to proper legalised marriages. But in fact it is a de facto relationship that is being referred to in the language that's employed. And if you read the literal translation, such as Rotherham, Interlinear Bible and others, you'll find that that's what comes out. So we read in verse 2 that Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam — Jehiel and Elam's names are mentioned amongst those who were guilty in this matter, but Shechaniah escapes — answered and said unto Israel, We have trespassed against our God, and have taken strange wives of the peoples, plural, of the land. Yet now, he says, there is hope in Israel concerning this thing. Why could he say that, brethren and sisters? If these men who had trespassed in this matter had taken these women and had legally married them and made them their wives, could there be hope? Would God have looked kindly upon the dissolution of marriage? We know what he thought about that when he spoke just a few short years later through Malachi. Yahweh hates putting away divorce. And Israel were practicing that just a few years later. And the problem then wasn't that they were taking other women of other nations. The problem then was that they were actually putting away their own Israelite wives to take Gentile women. Here was a problem of them taking Gentile women, presumably because there wasn't enough Israelite women to go around. When it says in verse 2 that they had taken strange wives, the words have taken in the Hebrew are the one word yashab, which means to sit down or to dwell with someone, to cause a woman to dwell with you. Doesn't necessarily mean you marry her. It means that you cause her to dwell with you. The word strange is the Hebrew word nokri, which means strange or foreign, and it's used in Nehemiah 13 verse 26 of the outlandish women that Solomon took. That is, they were foreign women. And the word wives in verse 2 is the same word as women back in verse 1. It's that word noshim. Alright, so Rotherham translates that, they have lived with foreign women, and the Interlinear Bible uses the same language. They had lived with foreign women in a de facto relationship. Now, those sort of relationships in today's society are plethora. In my workplace, there are probably as many people in that kind of relationship as there are in marriage. It's an incredible situation. But today, of course, it's looked upon as being legal. When you fill out your tax form, you've got to declare a de facto wife. No sort of legal joining together of these people, except for taxation purposes. So the world is practicing today what I believe was happening back in those days. They had brought these women into their homes, obviously to gratify the baser desires of their flesh, but not at the cost of taking them as wives. Now you might say to me, how do you know that? Well, there are a couple of suggestions. One is the consistency with which the translators, the literal translators, have translated that phrase. They have caused foreign women to dwell with them. And the other one is the last verse of chapter 10. Now from verse 15 onwards, we have in chapter 10 the list of those who were guilty. From verse 18, the list of those who were guilty. In verse 44, he winds it up by saying, all these had taken strange wives, or as Rotherham translates it, foreign women, and some of them had wives, or women, by whom they had children. Again, the Interlinear Bible says, and there were some of them with women, and they gave sons. Now, if they were in fact legal wives, and this had been going on for some years, then there would be no surprise about that, would there? No surprise in days when they didn't have quite the same precautions that people can take today to prevent the onset of children. No surprise that they should have had children by legal wives. But that verse is written almost as though this was a surprising thing, that they'd taken strange women and some of them had had children by them. So I believe that's a hint, brethren and sisters, that what they had was a de facto relationship. It hadn't been going on all that long. Long enough for some of them to produce children. So it was a problem in its early stages that could now be nipped in the bud. That's why this man Shechaniah says, yet now there is hope in Israel concerning this thing. You might say to me, well, why would you worry about all that? The reason I worried about that, brethren and sisters, is simply this, that if you get involved in the marriage argument, as one day we might, and you stand by the principle for which we all stand, one man, one woman, for life, and when you're married, that's it, you're locked up, you can't get out of that, no way, no divorce, absolutely no way of divorcing and certainly never remarriage, you stand for that, someone is going to throw at you Ezra chapter 10. Been thrown at me. They're going to throw at you Ezra chapter 10 and say, well, what about Ezra 10? They married outside the truth. They put them away. Divorce was sanctioned by God. Was it? Not if I read that chapter correctly. What happened was that they simply put away their de factos. And I'll tell you something. There have been some absolute disasters in the brotherhood in recent times because brethren have been saying to people who come to the truth in a de facto relationship, the first thing you've got to do is get married. That's what they've said. You're living together. You're man and wife, virtually man and wife. Almost as though putting two bodies together makes them man and wife. You're living together. Get married. First thing you do. It's an absolute disaster. And the trail has been littered with dead bodies because of that stupidity. I'll tell you what you've got to tell them, brethren and sisters, as simple as this. If anybody is in that situation, they come along with the truth and they're living with someone, the first thing you tell them to do, as soon as the truth starts to have an impact upon their life, is to get out of that situation. And when they've got the truth firmly in their grasp, then you tell them to look around for someone to marry in the truth. You think I get a bit upset about that? I'll tell you why I get upset. I've spent many hours chasing after people because of that very problem. Hours trying to talk people into doing the right thing. Hours and hours, brethren and sisters, sitting down with sisters, weeping their eyes out because they were forced into that situation by brethren who gave them the wrong advice. Let's get this clear. When a man and a woman are joined together physically, outside of marriage, that does not create a marriage. It creates fornication or adultery. That's all it creates. And the best advice you can give people in that situation is to split that relationship. Get out of it. Sort out themselves as far as the truth is concerned, and then start looking around to marry, if they're allowed to marry. Good policy, this. There was hope concerning this thing. It was de facto. And they could get out of it. So verse 3, now therefore let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the women and such as are born of them, according to the counsel of my Lord, of Yahweh, as it should read, and of those that tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Arise, for this matter belongeth unto thee. They're looking to him now, brothers and sisters. They're looking at this giant, this spiritual giant in their midst. Arise, for upon thee resteth the thing, Rotherham translates it. He had not just the authority from the king to teach that people his laws, Yahweh's laws. He had the authority in their eyes. He had the standing, the spiritual respect of that people. And they would listen to this man. So the counsel is, be of good courage, or as Rotherham puts it, be strong and act. And we need to do that sometimes. We need to be strong, we need to act. He did exactly that, verse 5. Then arose Ezra and made the chief priests, the Levites and all Israel to swear that they should do according to this word. And they swear. And here, brothers and sisters, is the way to handle ecclesial problems. You work to get people to cooperate together to make the necessary changes. You want success in ecclesial issues, you work as hard as you possibly can to get minds to come together to agree on what should be done. Get it down to the very basic elements of the principles of the truth that everybody can agree on. And when you can get common ground agreement, you then build on that. You'll never get everybody, brothers and sisters, to agree with the methodology that you might adopt to overcome a problem. But you can work to get everybody to agree with the principles involved. And if you can work towards that, then half or more of your problems are already gone. It's when you've got differences on the principles that you've got a big problem. Well, they work to get people to agree on the principle. And they all swear before their God that they would do something about this matter. And so in verse 6, Ezra rose up from before the house of God. He goes into a chamber. He did eat no bread, drank no water. He mourned because of the transgression of them that had been carried away. They made proclamation throughout all Judah and Jerusalem to bring all the people together. Verse 8, that whosoever would not come within 3 days, according to the counsel of the princes and the elders, all his substance should be forfeited, and himself separated from the people of the land. It was a fellowship matter, you see. And they brought them all together that they might act by consensus. It's always a more effective way than unilateral action. Ezra knew that. He could have got up and demanded certain things be done, but he knew he had to get the minds of the people locked together. To do that, you've got to get them to admit their guilt. Verse 9. From verses 9 to 14, we've got the people making that admission of guilt. And all the men of Judah and Benjamin gathered themselves together unto Jerusalem within 3 days. It was the ninth month. It was the month in which the heavy rains begin, brethren and sisters. It was the coldest month of the year. And it was the 20th day of the month, towards the end of that month. It was getting bitterly cold now. And we read at the end of verse 9, and all the people sat in the street of the house of God. They were in the broadway before the house. And they were trembling because of this matter and for the great rain. There were heavy rains at the time, and you can just imagine this great concourse of people. No umbrellas, no raincoats. They were out there in their heavy garments, and they were saturated to the skin, and they were there, men, women and children. They were all in that place to resolve this matter. And as they stood there shivering in the rain, Ezra the priest stood up in verse 10 and said, "Ye have transgressed and have taken strange women to increase the trespass of Israel. Now therefore take these 3 steps. Here they are, brothers and sisters, verse 11. 3 steps to recovery. Make confession unto Yahweh God of your fathers. There's the first step to reconciliation. We've got to admit, to confess our guilt before our God. And do his pleasure. The word pleasure means his will. As the Interlinear Bible has it. Do his will. So there's got to be repentance. Works fit for repentance. And separate yourself from the people of the land. We've got to act upon it to correct our way, to resolve the error in which we've been involved. Separate yourself from the people of the land and from the strange women. And all the congregation answered and said with a loud voice, as thou hast said, so must we do. They knew that they had to reform. But the people are many, they said, and it is a time of much rain, and we are not able to stand without. Neither is this a work of one day or two, for we are many that have transgressed in this thing. Now let our rulers of all the congregation stand, and let all them which have taken strange women in our cities come at an appointed time with the elders of every city and the judges thereof, until the fierce wrath of our God for this matter be turned from us. Excuse me. And so they came together for that purpose. The brethren and sisters, you can never get everybody on side. It's impossible. Look what verse 15 says. Only Jonathan, the son of Asahel, and Jehaziah, the son of Tikvah, were employed about this matter. And Meshullam and Shabbathai, the Levite, helped them. When it says, were employed about this matter, you'll notice that the margin says, stood. In fact, the translation should read this way. Literally it is, they stood against this. The word matter is not there. So Jonathan and Jehaziah stood against this, and there were a couple who supported them. It's always the case, isn't it? Now, we don't know just how prominent those men were, but it's always the case. You know what? I have never, ever seen it any different. Every problem that we have gone through over the years has been identical to this. Even when you can get almost a total consensus in your meeting that the issue, the principles, are agreed upon, when it comes to actually resolving the problem, the methodology, the approach, the formula that's used, you can never get everybody to agree with it. You simply cannot get 100% agreement. There's always someone who's got his own idea about it. It's one of the tragedies of ecclesial life. I suppose of human law, that there's always someone who's got a better idea. You know what? If we are reaching for anything in ecclesial life, brethren and sisters, it is this. It is the humility to keep our mouth shut. You know what? You want to learn a bit about this? Go along to a few business meetings. Now, Golden Grove business meetings, as I understand, I don't go to them as yet, are quite happy affairs. We've got people breaking up earthenware pots and climbing ladders, and we show a few slides and we laugh at ourselves. You want to ask a few brethren in this hall tonight what business meetings are like in a real ecclesia. You want to ask them whether or not it's an enjoyable experience to go along to a business meeting. I've been through a few humdingers in my life, brethren and sisters, when I've come away absolutely shattered and I thought I had a fair bit of resilience. You know, I've spent some nights where I can't get to sleep after a business meeting. You know that? And normally I hit the pillow and I'm out like that. You wait till we get to an ecclesial situation when it's like that. And learn this lesson now. That if you want to contribute to the peace and harmony of your meeting, don't be the man with the big ideas. That when the ecclesia generally agrees that something ought to be done, you might not necessarily agree with everything that's done or the way that they attempt to do it. Keep your mouth shut. That's what it boils down to. Be humble enough to say that the brethren who are in charge might not always do everything like I would do it, but they're trying to do the right thing, and give them the support they need. Keep your mouth closed and we'll have a happy ecclesia. But if you want to be like these fellows, then we'll have an unhappy ecclesia. They stood against this. What damage did they do to that work? We don't know. Whether they were hardliners or softliners, we don't know. What we do know is that they weren't humble enough to accept that they were overshadowed by an enormous spiritual giant who knew exactly what had to be done and was doing it the right way. We've got some lessons to learn in life, brethren and sisters, and that's one of them. If we think that we're the man of ideas, then we've got a few problems to overcome. And so we read that they went about the task of sorting themselves out. Verse 16, they examined the matter, as it says at the end of the verse. And they made an end with all the men that had taken strange women by the first day of the first month. They made an end of 3 months of activity to clean up that problem. They dispatched all those strange women, those de facto wives, even with the babies that had been born. Dispatched them. Got their house in order. And got back to the work of building in the house of God. And there was an ecclesial problem that had been resolved. Resolved in the way that all ecclesial problems should be resolved. Not by brethren getting up and saying, well, I can't have this sort of thing going on in the meeting. I'm not going to tolerate that. That's below my standards. That's beyond me to handle. I can't handle that. I'm leaving. And off they go to Enfield or Teetra Gully or somewhere else. Is that the way to solve problems? Oh no, brethren and sisters. The way to solve problems is to look at the problem and say, it could be me. That's me. I'm not going to do something about saving myself. And as you work to save your brother, brothers and sisters, you're working to save yourself. That's what Ezra did. He did it in a spirit of humility and a desire to save his people from disaster, a desire to bring to pass, to help to bring to pass the promises of God which he saw in jeopardy. He did it because he felt shame. Utter shame that the people did not appreciate what had been done for them. And he brought them to an appreciation that they might obey their God out of love and a desire to give themselves wholly to him because they were grateful for what had been done to them. That's how we ought to be. And if we can approach problems like that, brothers and sisters, then we won't have to worry. We won't have to worry about disasters overtaking us. But we'll need to learn those lessons. And you can be assured of this, brethren and sisters, if Yahweh wants to mould us as an ecclesia and as individuals, He's going to put us to the test one day. We're going to find out whether or not we really have learnt those lessons.